Learn from today's most innovative brands and observe how they empower employees, engage consumers, design products, and co-create experiences together. Welcome to the Brand Lab series from AE Marketing Group.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Walker. We're excited to have you with us. This is episode 28 of the Brand Lab series podcast, broadcasting from 1871 Chicago, where each Tuesday we explore today's most innovative brands alongside today's most insightful executives and entrepreneurs. This week, I'm excited to have back with us Russ Klein. Russ is the CEO of the American Marketing Association, and we're going to be talking about brand transformation. And with that said, let's enter the Brand Lab. So I'm excited to welcome Russ back. Russ was with us for a prior episode and was so compelling that we wanted to bring him back and talk about a different topic. For those of you who aren't familiar with him, he's been an icon in the industry for many, many years. Adweek had named him the Advertiser of the Decade in the 2000s. He was really a pioneer in some of the early digital marketing efforts of that decade. He's also been dubbed the Flamethrower for some of his very provocative ideas around challenging the status quo in marketing. Super thrilled to have you back, Russ. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Brian.
So you have incredible experience, both from a business and a brand perspective. As we touched on real briefly in our first conversation, that includes a lot of turnarounds. And that's a thing that often scares a lot of marketers, because trying to turn a brand that's struggling around is probably one of the hardest jobs a marketer could have. But what about that excites you?
Yes. Well, I have to say, I began to wonder throughout my career if there ever was such a thing as a job that wasn't a turnaround assignment. Maybe they just all came my way over the course of my career. But I had the good fortune to work for a gentleman who is now passed, John Albers, who was the chairman and CEO of Dr. Pepper 7-Up, who believed in me at the age of 29 to make me the CMO there. And I clearly was not as qualified as 10,000 other people who could have gone into that job. But John believed in me, and he saw something in me. And the Dr. Pepper 7-Up business was one that was in somewhat dire straits. Philip Morris had just sold off the 7-Up brand after years of frustration and failure to grow that business. And John gave me some advice early on. He said, "Russ, turnarounds are not about turning around brands. They're about turning around people." And that always stuck with me, in that, you know, we have our heads down on the spreadsheets and on the documents and on the research and the customer data and so forth. And we think that there's a puzzle there that we're going to solve intellectually, which of course is a key part of the job. But John's point was that it's through people that you will generate change, and it's through people then that, you know, you can create new outcomes. And, you know, over time, I've accumulated a number of other beliefs and principles around change management, which is really the underlying theme to a turnaround. You know, the concept is, of course, that if the business is experiencing a negative trajectory, there's no reason to believe that a trend isn't going to continue to be a trend until something changes. So the question is, what is the right change? Change can just be motion, or it can be progress. And so identifying the way forward and doing that through people, again, through inspiration, is the only way I know to do that. And so I found just change management to be a fascinating, and probably why I wound up involved in so many turnarounds.
I love the Dr. Pepper analogy, because, you know, John trusting you with that leadership role, the way the brand was, and the fact that you were 29 years old, that's what's so interesting is, obviously, as marketers now, what do you hear so much about? Millennials, millennials, millennials. So you were really ahead of the curve to be a 29-year-old CMO. So that, you know, that says a lot. And you've talked a lot already about culture and talent and empowerment. So that's really great. Now let's flash forward just a couple years to the AMA now. So with the American Marketing Association, I also think it's interesting because you've had also some backgrounds with Burger King and other franchise-related brands. You know, the American Marketing Association is ginormous. It's a large national organization, but it also has a lot of regional chapters. So talk about how you've been realigning and kind of transforming that brand over the last 2 years. It's been exciting to watch from the sidelines.
Oh, thank you. So it's interesting. You're right. I've worked on a lot of brands, whether it be soft drinks, where there's distributor networks, 7-Eleven, where there are franchisees, a number of QSR brands with franchise networks. And I describe all those models as models that have a plurality of power. There's the so-called headquarters or parent company, and then, as you've described in the model, is this whole other tier of critical stakeholders that without their alignment, you cannot get things done. And I certainly learned in that model, one of my mottos was that the store manager trumps the brand manager every time. And that it is not enough to have a great idea at the headquarters of the operation. If you cannot inspire alignment at the front line where that experience is being delivered, and I've seen great ideas turned into nothing, end up going nowhere because of lack of alignment, and I've seen mediocre ideas around which people were all lined up and ready to go execute, create real business results. So the power of that alignment, the valuing of all the stakeholders in your ecosystem is an important insight that I certainly brought with me to the AMA. And as a result, I took an outside-in approach. The first 18 months on the job, as I come up to my two-year anniversary here in a few weeks, I probably hit 50 different cities, spending time with stakeholders so that I could return to them with what they told me was needed. And I described it as a stakeholder-built plan, saying, I hope you recognize this plan because you contributed to it. And I saw a lot of nodding heads, of course, saying, that's what we said, that's what we need, and so now we're on board. And again, that to me is the way you enroll and build alignment, is through a lot of elbow grease, if you will, in terms of stakeholder management. And you know, sometimes too much stakeholder management can be distracting. Right. And so I call that sometimes friction costs. Right. If you're spending more than a day a week on stakeholder management, I think then you're starting to incur maybe friction costs. But probably 20% of your time in any given week should be spent on making sure that not just do I have the right ideas, but do I have all the people needed to agree that this is the right idea on board?
And throughout that journey, which I'm sure in some ways feels like it's flown by the last almost 2 years, in other ways it's probably felt like dog years, talk about maybe a bump in the road and how you guys kind of work together to overcome that.
Well, I would say that when you are in a state of transformation, which the AMA is right now, we have bumps in the road every day. The way to navigate them is to face them, acknowledge them as reality, try to bring an alignment around you know, what I call dissatisfaction. One of the pieces of learning that I picked up along the way from Michael Beers at Harvard Business School on organizational behavior is that change equals a vision times a strategy times D. And D stands for dissatisfaction. And the reason he has multiplication signs in there is that the best vision, the best strategy, without universal dissatisfaction with the way things are now, is going to be multiplied times zero, and therefore there'll be no change. And so building a common understanding, a common awareness of, hey, the way things are right now are not satisfactory. And so if we can agree to that, then we can engage into solutions collectively. One of the other concepts I've always loved too is this idea of the bystander effect. You know, when you're in the middle of a transformation, I'm sure some of our older listeners would know about the Kitty Genovese story in New York in the 60s, who was a victim of a murder, a vicious murder, of which there were 38 people who supposedly listened to and in some cases observed the crime in action and did not call the police. Now, there was no 911 back then, but you could still call the police. And that then became named the bystander effect. And the idea of it was that that the more people who think there are others able to solve the solution, the more likely they are to think that someone else will make the call and that they don't need to. And so, you know, what I've shared on occasion with folks is that if the bystander effect can result in the death of a human being, it can result in the death of an organization. And so let's all be active. Let's all not assume that, you know, someone else is going to do something. If you see something, not only just say something, but do something about it. And so these are, again, teachable lessons around, I think, an environment that is that where the mandate is transformation and change management is something that's going on every day.
That's so close to my own heart, because 20 years ago when I graduated college, I wrote my senior thesis on bystander conformity. And Anna and many people that are with me will hear me talk about that quite a bit, actually, the bystander conformity mentality. So really interesting perspective on some of the evolution of the AMA with you and your leadership team and your stakeholders throughout the last 2 years. Let's look just broader inside the industry. What's a recent kind of brand that you've noticed that you feel maybe was on a downward trend or maybe fell out of vogue with consumers? But what's a brand that you see is kind of doing a good job of either transforming in our digital era or maybe is kind of reinventing itself?
Well, I can't think of a brand that jumps out at me who there are a lot of brands out there that are doing a great job who have come onto the scene, you know, brands like Uber, Amazon. My observation about that is how profoundly brands like that are changing expectations across all categories. You know, marketers used to look inside their own space and say, well, here's the gold standard for customer satisfaction. Now the gold standard are these transcendent concepts that have become part of pop culture, like Uber, like Amazon. And people expect a frictionless experience in every respect. If they are getting it on Uber, they expect it on United Airlines. They expect it, you know, elsewhere, regardless of whether the airline industry thinks that they have a different set of standards. Uber and Amazon and others like them are changing the expectation, you know, for customers out there. I think also that, again, we talked about digitization in the modern enterprise. What I think is really exciting is what is sort of like a tip of the iceberg, which there is so much more to come around turning dumb products into smart products out there, particularly on the industrial side with the use of sensors. And when you think about how intelligent products both at an industrial and a consumer level are going to become in service to our society, the opportunities are so exciting. And that's what kind of catches my attention.
And do you see something along the lines of co-creation being a great opportunity to help organizations transform, not just from a brand, but from a business and a digital perspective today?
Absolutely. There's work by a prominent academic in the marketing community, V.K. Kumar, who has written a book around profitable customer engagement recently. It's a great read, and great insights around what really constitutes customer engagement. And he basically will define that an engaged customer is a customer who not only gives value back to the brand directly through a transaction, through money, but then also indirectly by getting involved in the brand through word of mouth, feedback, blogs, shares, likes, all of those sort of co-creation dynamics, and that there is no such thing as a customer engagement with a brand until both of those factors are at work for a brand. So this idea of co-creation is an important part of engagement. I used to say that a brand is the promise plus the experience. And I've revised my equation to say a brand is the story plus the experience, because now that story is not just the story the company tells. That story is the story that is co-created by its customer and by the consuming public. And that story plus that experience now becomes what a brand is and whether or not it actually represents an engaged relationship with a customer.
totally agree. I think it's absolutely critical for today's brands to give customers, and in some cases maybe even non-customers, a seat at the design table so that they can work together to create new products or services or experiences. And I think that gets to a little bit of a tug of war right now with today's marketers, especially in the C-suite, and that is around the customer experience. You talked about that real briefly in our last episode, and you just had a great analogy, I think, with between technology and brands like Uber and Amazon, the expectation game has been raised so high. Anybody with a smartphone now is a critic, an author, a photojournalist. Consumers have so much power. And by default, sometimes there's this question of should experience live within the CMO vertical? I'm curious what responsibility or role you think marketers should have with customer experience today.
Well, I think there are some business models where a customer experience can be placed in, from an organizational chart standpoint, can be placed under the CMO. But I think most models, just out of inertia, are always going to have some part of the customer experience that sits outside the CMO's direct reporting structure. But again, that doesn't mean that the CMO can't be a source of orchestration, a source of design influence, a source of insight into that experience so that other individuals at the C-suite responsible for delivering that experience are aligned in making sure that it's a coherent and cohesive one. You know, it's easy to say, well, you know, since I'm the CMO, our organization should be customer centric, so therefore everything should report to me, right? I don't think that's realistic. There are certain aspects of a business model where I think healthy tensions actually lead to better work. And so long as the CEO is encouraging those healthy tensions and is keeping the organization focused on the customer, they will result in better work product, better innovation, and a better customer experience.
Yeah, it seems like some of the secret sauce is obviously setting the right tone from a leadership and culture perspective. Because as you talked about earlier, you can have a leadership team talk about being customer-centric, but if your frontline workers are not customer-centric, they're the ones that are interacting with the consumers, and those are the ones that are going to really be at the front lines of your brand. So that's really interesting. As we start to wind down, we talked about a number of things with your background with brand transformation. I'd like to pivot just a little bit along the lines of transformation, but more from like a leadership perspective. You know, obviously I knew who you were before I met you today. You're very famous. You've got an incredible track record of work in the industry. One of the things though that I loved is this notion that at one point you transformed from a flamethrower to a torchbearer. And I'd love for you to just expand upon that just a little bit in terms of that journey. Is someone who myself is a little older actually in his marketing career. Talk about like the flamethrower and the torchbearer and what that means to you.
Well, the flamethrower language came, I think, from Adweek or some industry publication, and it stemmed from a lot of the work we were doing at the time at Burger King, which was viewed as provocative and controversial. And you know, when I came into the organization, the brand was on 7 straight years of negative sales, and so it was in a dire state. I was fortunate to have an amazing board and a CEO who really empowered me to just do something and act. And managerial courage was valued in the organization. And that's what I really loved most, because I was asked a question on a panel the other day about whether or not the best ideas out there are actually getting to the market. And I think I shocked some people, maybe disappointed them, when I said I don't think the best ideas are getting to the market. Now, we see many that do, but I would contend that there are many times more that have ended up on conference room floors or editing room floors because someone was unwilling to take a stand. You know, I don't think you can inspire if you don't take a stand now and then. Have the managerial courage to take a point of view for a brand. And so that's kind of what was underneath, I think, that label of flamethrower, which was just, to me, being true to your principles, being willing to take a stand, and having the managerial courage to weather the, you know, all that came with, you know, making a principled decision. Of course, a lot of what we did was ushering in digital advertising with our partners at Crispin Porter Bogusky back in the early 2000s. Moving to the torchbearer role from flamethrower, for me, has been an adjustment because my responsibilities now, I think, require that the flame itself maybe be not burning quite as hot, but that it's somehow brighter. It's a slower burn, you know, because the responsibility is to take a brand and a community that's been around for almost 80 years and ensure that it's around for another 80 and that it stays relevant. So the visioning, I think, has been maybe more important in the role that I'm now playing. Again, the ability to put our stakeholders and our customers in that vision so they can see themselves in it. And that's where, you know, the torch is really about providing a broader light for the community, whereas flamethrower had more to do, I think, with my managerial behavior and some of my decisions in the past.
Well, as we wrap up, I want to talk about kind of a different light. As we've talked about, you're very well known in the industry. You've done tremendous work. One of the things I did not know about you is some of the great charitable work you do. And you talked about lights. You talked about community. That's something that's been critical to us in the 6 years that I started AE Marketing Group. We've been involved with 28 non-for-profits here in Chicago, nationally, globally. Because I think it's important to give back when you do well, and that's just good for the community. I loved reading a little bit about a Mother's Love Foundation. That really touched me, and I thought, wow, that says a lot that someone who's been so successful has thought about giving back to others. Talk about why that's important to you.
You surprised me with your knowledge of that, and I appreciate the question. My father died when I was 2 years old, and so my mother raised my brothers and I while being a working woman. And she inherited a family-owned business in Cleveland, Ohio that was a steel company. So you can imagine in the early 60s, a woman having to step into the breach in a steel company in Cleveland. She got bumped around and bruised around a bit. And I used to watch, you know, her come home after those long days, knowing what she was sacrificing for us. And so I was a latchkey kid, I guess, was described in the day. So it just always stuck with me, you know, the sacrifice that she made. And when I had the chance to do something at a point in my career, I decided to honor my mother and create a foundation at Ohio State University that I endowed, and it produces scholarships each year for students who come from families with working moms, single parent homes. And it was just a way for me to sort of, you know, keep alive honoring that sacrifice.
I didn't mean to surprise you, but I just think that was such a wonderful story from, you know, all the headlines that you read about your career through the Wall Street Journal, Adweek, all that stuff, to kind of see a little bit more. I think it speaks a lot to you as a man and as a leader. And we certainly would like to try to support that cause as well. So, Russ, thank you so much for being on the Brand Lab series. Thank you for coming to 1871, sharing your incredible experience, insight, and wisdom with fellow executives across many industries. So thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Brian.
I want to thank our listeners for joining us in the Brand Lab today and to invite you back next Tuesday as we continue our journey of today's most innovative brands as we learn how they empower employees, engage consumers, design products, and co-create experiences together. Until next time.
Hi, this is Russ Klein, CEO of the American Marketing Association. I hope you'll check out what's happening at AMA.org called The Marketplace, where you'll find smarter, more useful content, connect with other marketers, Find out what's next in the industry and supercharge your career.
To listen to our other Brand Lab Series podcast episodes, visit iTunes, Google Play, or brandlabseries.com. Follow us on Twitter at Brand Lab Series. And if you have any questions or ideas for a future Brand Lab Series podcast, email us at info@brandlabseries.com.